this hearing of the Senate Community and Regional Affairs. This hearing of the Senate Community and Regional Affairs Committee will now come to order. It is now 1:31 p.m., Tuesday, January 31st, 2023, in Belts 105. Members present are Senator Gray Jackson, Vice Chair Olson, Senator Giesel, Senator Bjorkman, and myself, Chair Dunbar. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Thank you. Before we begin, I would like to thank Juliana Singh, the Senate Community and Regional Affairs Recording Secretary. And, actually, I didn't catch, who do we have here from the Juno LIO? Kelsey Riker. Thank you very much, Ms. Riker. We have one item on the agenda today, an overview of the Alaska Municipal League and their work with local governments from their executive director, Nils Andreessen. In the room, we have Nils Andreessen. Mr. Andreessen, would you like to come forward, please, and put yourself on the record and begin your presentation? Now, would you prefer members hold their questions until the end or ask them throughout the presentation?
Either way.
Given that there are 42 slides, we might have a couple of interruptions. Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for being here. Please begin.
Thank you. For the record, Nils Andreessen, I'm the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League. Today I want to focus on, I think, an ever-evolving role of AML and the work that we're doing to support communities here in Alaska. We'll talk a little bit about some of our member priorities and reference resolutions that have been adopted by AML membership. And then if we have time, I'll touch on some of the work that we're doing for infrastructure development in the state. When I started at AML 5 years ago, we were a very different organization. And I think that's important to know, that we held our conferences for members to exchange best practices and learn from state and federal officials and each other. We advocated on behalf of members and produced a number of other publications and other items that complemented the work of local government. But I think of AML now as a member service organization that's delivering direct value and indirect benefits to members in ways that we just didn't contemplate 5 years ago. So I want to talk just a little bit about that. Our mission, purpose, objectives comes from our Articles of Incorporation, which I think are the best in the state and maybe nation. They allow AML to be so active in support of local governments and take on issues that are directly related to cities and boroughs in the state, but also to residents and thinking about the positive and negative impacts of state federal decision making on all of Alaska in a lot of ways. I come back often to those Articles of Incorporation, a very simple mission statement to strengthen Alaska's local governments. And we do that in so many different ways, beyond events that we hold or advocacy that we conduct. We really want to, and I think have work to do, to become a contributor to how municipal governance occurs in Alaska. And in our Articles of Incorporation actually ask us to do that, to develop best practices and models of governance that could be implemented at the local level. We do have a broad scope. And another reason I love my job, I can just about do anything in this position in supporting local governments. So that could range from co-sponsoring the Alaska Broadband Summit this last year with Senator Sullivan, or two infrastructure symposiums last year with Senator Murkowski. It could include me spending my mornings while my five-year-old is watching Minecraft YouTube, me calculating out the changes in sales tax revenue over the years across municipalities, and diving deep into data sets that help me better understand how and why and when local governments make decisions about their revenues. And I will say that that analysis led us to really better understand the impacts of removing community assistance and how communities responded when that occurred. I know that a retirement system has come up a few times already this legislative session. It's a priority for AML members. But this, I think AML's role is to be looking at, again, what are national best practices? Who's doing things differently or right or contributing in different ways to retention and recruitment efforts? And so we can track things like Tennessee's public pension plan success. And what does that mean based on the evaluation that Pew and others have conducted? So it's really wide ranging. And I mentioned services before. We're looking at short-term rentals and housing issues. We're looking at childcare solutions. The company that we're working with on short-term rentals has also allowed us to collect remote sales tax for 45 jurisdictions and increasing revenues for local governments about $20 million this last year, which is a very small amount compared to the total collected revenue by jurisdictions, but is meaningful, especially in a downturn. So we can do just about anything in support of our members, and I would say in support of Alaska communities. These last 5 years have been defined in some ways by, it seems like, opportunity and crisis each year, and whether that was the Supreme Court case that allowed us to start collecting, developing a system to collect a remote sales tax, to a very acute fiscal crisis and a budget that our members responded to and the legislature responded to help soften the blow to communities. Public health emergency and economic crisis, federal relief packages through CARES Act and ARPA, and this last year through the infrastructure package. Every year has brought a new layer of challenge to Alaska's local governments, and an opportunity for AML to be part of a solution in supporting them. And AML's grown, where when I started 5 years ago, we were 3 people, we're 14 now, and a budget that is making investments back into local government. So it's really kind of an impressive arc in a lot of ways.
Nils, can I ask you a question there briefly? Well, it's not a question so much as, just to clarify, I think people don't realize part of that evolution when you say, you know, the remote sales tax was an opportunity for local governments. Beyond that, you actually are the contractor that does that for them in some cases and receive some revenue to do that. Is that correct?
Right. Chair Dunbar. Yeah, I mean, I think that AML is a nonprofit, but I think more than that, we're an interlocal organization. We respond directly to the interests of members. And we have an administrative function in collecting, administering those funds for remote sales tax. We're collecting the physical sales tax for 4 communities right now. We have a health insurance program. We've got a retirement program and deferred compensation. So yeah, I think it's you know, beyond a nonprofit, it's really a member support, shared services organization.
Thank you.
The last, we helped organize under ARPA, the American Rescue Plan Act, a website that was focused on ARPA 2 years ago, and with the introduction and passage of the Infrastructure Investment Act, the bipartisan infrastructure law, are the host to this akfederalfunding.org, a one-stop shop for all federal grant opportunities that have some intersection with or eligibility that local governments are eligible for. So we have a ton of resources there related to ARPA, related to infrastructure, with the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act and increased attention to pollution prevention and energy efficiency and air quality. We'll continue to see this develop. But we have a whole team at AML now dedicated to infrastructure, more staff than we had staff to begin with 5 years ago. That's focused on supporting this effort, providing grant writing assistance and technical assistance to local governments, tribes, nonprofits, school districts. Much of that's been, or that effort's been supported with legislative funding this last year, which is really helpful, but complemented by funds from Rasmussen Foundation and Denali Commission and through contracts that we have with state agencies and others. none of this is possible without partnerships. Beyond AML, we do have two sister organizations, the AML Joint Insurance Association and the AML Investment Pool, providing property and workers' comp insurance to the majority of local governments in Alaska. And when you think about insurance and how that, what the state decision-making apparatus looks like, it's at the state level, it's at the local level, but also thinking about pools like that are created under statute, I think is important. The investment pool manages about $700 million on behalf of local governments. It's similar to the state Jafonzi account. If you have questions, it's a general fund investment. It's where a lot of UGF, I think, is kept. It's one way. I mean, basically, can we pool together? Can we work together as municipalities to see some benefit and efficiency and economy of scale? AML is not alone in the nation. We are unique. We're the only organization like ours that responds both to county equivalent interests and city. So we have both boroughs and cities as part of our membership, where every other state has a county association and a municipal league. And we brought that under one body. And we work closely with the National Association and the National League of Cities. I'm on one of their board of directors, and well, on both boards of directors, I think, in some capacity. But we're directly interfacing with our colleagues at a federal and national level, and bringing those benefits, that advocacy, that understanding back to Alaska local governments, which is really a valuable contribution I think we can make. I sit on the board or on the commission of the Denali Commission. We have a MOA with the Alaska Department of Transportation. I'm on a project development committee with the Federal Land Access Program. So all kinds of relationships that are part of the work that we're doing. And it's not just AML. It's really our role with partners in delivering value to local governments. If there's nothing else we take away from today's presentation, I want to make sure that I convey just how different local governments are from one another. And it's so easy in some ways to think about, one decision impacting everybody equally. And often state or federal decisions impact local governments in so many different kinds of ways, or not at all, depending on what the issue is. But not all local governments are created equal. Not all deliver powers or responsibilities equally or have them, and not all have the same capacity. So where you might have a larger local government with many departments and hundreds of employees, there are so many of our members who are operating with a half-time staff and trying to do all the same things to get things done. 70 of our local governments have police powers, though arguably they all got some public safety responsibility, a combined budget that's well more than the Department of Public Safety. So when we think about who's doing public safety in Alaska, we can't think just the state. And I think that partnership between state and local is really critical. Local governments manage just as many road miles as the Alaska Department of Transportation and public facilities. Are almost entirely responsible for Alaska's ports and harbors and for a fishing industry that is one of the most advanced economic sectors in the state. Almost completely responsible for water and wastewater systems in Alaska. Run the majority of, or at least are responsible to, the majority of school districts in Alaska, with responsibilities for school construction and major maintenance. Own 75% of all schools. Our school facilities, and when we think about education funding, there's a clear intersection with the role of local governments and their tax base. Finally, it's really local governments who are responsible for quality of life in communities, and that could be public libraries or pools or parks and rec type activities. But I think important for local governments is it's not just the infrastructure that people need or businesses need to be in a place, but a community. And often we see local governments in Alaska supporting so many aspects of community to keep families there, to keep businesses whole and healthy, and to keep communities healthy.
Yes, I'm sorry.
As you go back to some of the ports and harbors, are you actually actively, what role do you play in those communities that either want improvements or want to build a new harbor or anything like that?
Yeah, through the chair, Vice Chair Olson. For AML, there is we support the Alaska Harbor Masters and Port Administrators Association, which does more direct technical assistance to those municipalities or those enterprises. We conducted a survey last year that tried to identify and get our arms around the infrastructure deficit that ports and harbors are experiencing. I want to say just for 1 year, $300 to $600 million in needs, and probably I've left out municipality of Anchorage as part of that number. But I think really understanding what those infrastructure needs look like and improvements and why they might be necessary. I think for AML, our role is advocating for the Municipal Harbor Match grant funds, which I think isn't funded this year, for instance, but is a partnership between the state of Alaska that transferred a lot of those assets to local governments and local governments who are now in charge of maintaining them and improving them based on kind of the condition that they were inherited. So local governments provide 50% of the funds for those harbor improvements, and the state the other 50% when that program is running.
Mr. Chairman, if I could go back.
Yes, Mr. Vice Chairman.
The AML organizational development, you talked about AML and some of the roles that it's involved with, one of which is the AML investment pool. You talked about $700 million that you're managing. Is that true? Was I right in my...
Right.
And then what? When you have a rate of return on that, how do you distribute the monies that come forth from that?
Yeah. Through the chair, Vice Chair Olson. In terms of AMLIP, the AML investment pool, it's managed separately, independently from AML by a board of directors that has the fiduciary responsibility. It's managed by The funds are actually managed by a vendor with custodian responsibilities and investment management responsibilities. There's an investment advisor separately, so it's kind of a three-party endeavor to make sure that those funds are invested accurately and safely for members. Each of those funds are distinct, and so they're managed separately, but as a pool. And the market rates that accrue to the pool are pro rata kept track of for each account. So there's maybe 80 members with 160 accounts kind of within that. There's a pretty sophisticated process for managing their funds.
How are the proceeds, essentially the interest, how are they distributed throughout those investors?
Right. Through the chair, the returns on those funds go back into those accounts.
Also, they're distributed to the community.
Through the chair, Vice Chair Olson, it's available to the communities at any point. They have 24-hour, round-the-clock access to drawing down funds. It's really a cash management tool, just like the state might otherwise leverage, and the rate of return is very similar to your market rates.
Thank you, Vice Chair Olson. Can you continue, Mr. Anderson?
I want to run through just in terms of what that makeup of communities looks like when we're thinking about issues that are important to us. So first, you'll all be familiar with our borough classifications and the differences between home rule and second-class boroughs, for instance, and the unorganized borough. In a lot of ways, all the state is organized, just one of our boroughs is named unorganized, with some responsibility to the legislature to act as its assembly. But our home rule boroughs are between non-unified and unified home rule, basically can do anything they need to according to charter and not prescribed or not... not outlined in law or restricted in law. And then your second-class boroughs can do anything allowed to them in law, and that's the real difference. And so the reality is that even when we're thinking about a borough-level government, and each of these has three primary responsibilities, they all have to tax, they all have planning responsibilities, and they all have school district responsibilities, which is why they have to tax. They're each required to contribute 2.65 mils or equivalent. But beyond that, it's very different between the powers that they exercise, their tax base, and their responsibilities. If you think of all local governments in Alaska, 165 cities and boroughs spread across the state in home rule first class, second class, a structure, and at the city level, the same functionality occurs between home rule and second class cities. The legislature for second class says here's what you must or allowed to do, and for home rule, it's determined by voters in those communities. The 165 cities and boroughs out of 229. Communities across the state, so everything else would be in an unincorporated city with a different type of governance model and responsibilities picked up by the state or tribal government. Cities in the unorganized borough, you can see here the ones. It might be worth saying that for cities in the unorganized borough that are home rule or first class, they also have some responsibility for a school district and also contribute that the 2.65 mils or equivalent and above often. So they have responsibilities for public education, and the rest as second-class cities don't. So that's kind of the makeup of local government in Alaska. Again, where there are cities within an organized borough, they come together and very different combinations, and there's a lot of collaboration then that goes on within those regions. Not everybody has a sales tax. Out of 165 cities and boroughs, roughly 100 communities have a 106 have a sales tax, so many do not. The revenue from sales tax is when we think about revenue, nowhere near kind of the revenue that's collected for property tax in Alaska, but incredibly meaningful for most of these communities. And for some where you have more revenue, it's usually a combination of property and sales tax that, that contributes to the overall tax revenue that local governments have in place. Here's for property taxes, a smaller group. I think just approximately 40 with property taxes. So again, sales taxes, much more likely that a city would have a sales tax around the state, and then property taxes. Almost all boroughs have a property tax. Where there's not, and there's only a couple, there's a PILT in place, a payment in lieu of taxes, in at least one of those. In a couple others, it's a fish tax that is basically the equivalent for property.
Yes, Mr. Vice Chairman.
Is that Accutane that's down there on the lower part there on the Aleutian chain? And it's a first class city?
Should be on Alaska.
Alaska, I thought would be on the other side of the island.
It could be. The dots are.
I think you're talking about.
Yeah.
Alaska. It's on Alaska.
Yeah, the dot where Anchorage, the red dot for Anchorage is a little bit more inland.
It's like they've shifted a little bit.
Yeah. Okay. So yep. This might be a little bit of an error.
Right.
Yeah, no big deal.
For the record, putting dots on maps is not my expertise. Now I'm going to question all of my so they're guesstimate, they're approximations of where dots might be. This is where the Alaska Marine Highway System impacts local governments, and a huge return on that investment for those communities, and I know how important it is for coastal communities. and for travel, tourism, and the economy that system is in place. Communities impacted by PERS decisions. It's not right to think that all local governments are part of PERS. There was only 64 that are out of that 165. They make up 18% of the contributions or payroll or net pension liability, depending on how you want to measure it, for the PERS system. And then even within this, I think I was running the numbers probably during a YouTube video, but I think it would take 77 of not just local government, 77 employers within the PERS system to make up 1% of the PERS contribution. So I think it's important to know that even though there's 64 local governments that are participating, many of them are at a very, very minuscule level in terms of the system as a whole.
Before you move on there, so what is the typical benefit structure for the communities that are not part of PERS?
Chair Dunbar, they don't have them.
Okay. They don't have anything at all? They haven't gone into the private marketplace, and perhaps some kind of 401k system or anything like that?
Right. Chair Dunbar and for the committee, I think we produce a salary survey, which I could get back to you, that could try to capture that. I think where you're not participating in PERS, you're really talking about very small communities with little capacity, where community assistance might be 80% of your budget, and there's just not a lot of resources to put more into employee benefits. There are, some have deferred comp plans, potentially, but even, health insurance is a stretch for some, so it's not... Yeah, it's not a straightforward it's not straightforward that they would have benefits like we might expect.
Senator Giesel.
So, Nils, would they be in Social Security then? Would the teachers be getting Social Security?
Senator Giesel, through the chair, teachers will all be. All the school districts are in PERS or TERS, or PERS and TERS, but. I would say that the PERS employers would not be from those home rule or first class cities.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Please continue.
Yeah. Small list, municipal hospitals, when you're thinking healthcare, local governments have some role there, and it's important to them what decisions get made about healthcare, and each of these had different roles too during a public health emergency, so it's worth knowing how they might have been impacted on that front. Petroleum property tax applies to those that have organized in relation to oil and gas infrastructure assets. If more of the state organized, that would look differently, but that's what petroleum property tax looks like. Fisheries taxes is actually pretty spread out, depending on the type of share tax. You can see how prevalent the fisheries really is. For some of these communities, it's 95% of their revenue base. For others, it's 1%. So a huge variation in how fisheries taxes are collected and what they mean to individual communities. School contributions. Here's what those who are making school contributions, about half the state covered by municipal school districts in some capacity, together making up about 26% total of public education contributions in the state.
Can I ask a question on this slide? So Anchorage doesn't have a dot here. Am I misunderstanding sort of what school contributions mean? Because I was always under the impression that we did contribute the maximum that we were legally allowed to do so.
Chair Dunbar, I think... Anchorage here is considered a borough, so it's a broader blue box. Same position.
Okay, so it's not the dots, it's the boxes.
It's the box, yeah. Anything that's colored or dotted in this. School bond debt. Not all of those with school contributions have school bond debt, and even those who do feel it very differently. I think that, for instance, like Kodiak Island Borough, if they had to pick up the entirety of school bond debt reimbursement. It's like 86% of their an annual budget. It's a pretty big lift. Aleutian Z is 56%. It's for some a very significant portion of their budget when that doesn't come through. PCE distribution across the state and which communities benefit from working to lower costs for them. A small amount of direct benefit to local governments and the indirect benefit, you know, really keeping residents whole in those communities. Police powers, again, 70 local governments with some form of police, 40 law enforcement, 40 police departments, and then the other 30 would have village police officers. And I mean, even for like, our salary survey will show that, you know, for some of those with village police officers, it's minimum wage that they're able to offer those charged with public safety in the community.
Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Did we skip over PCE or I was asleep, John?
Through the chair, I think I went very quickly through PCE.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Gray Jackson. Please continue, Mr. Jackson.
I would say for PCE, I do forget the number of communities, but it's a very significant part of what keeps them healthy as a community. If I shift gears from here's the makeup of local government and what they do here in Alaska to our priorities and resolutions. I didn't dive deep into any of these, and so I've made some high-level comments about that reflect resolutions that members have adopted. I can comment on them briefly, but can also get you a resolutions packet that might supplement anything I might offer today. So cross-cutting impacts, I think broadly speaking, we know that inflation is affecting local governments. We've had a number of reports where an infrastructure project, the quote budget that was submitted and awarded a grant last year, they go out to market and it's a 140% increase on what they were expecting. So we know that that this is affecting local governments, infrastructure investments, and decreasing purchasing power across the board. Housing is a big issue in communities at our August Legislative Conference. Housing and child care were two of the top priorities that local governments identified as increasingly challenging, both for residents and for their economic development. Supply chain issues. This isn't an issue for everybody, but where you have water and wastewater projects, where you have public transit, transportation projects, this is certainly a big deal and will affect project implementation as infrastructure investments start flowing after the number of federal investments start coming through. Finally, population demographics is a big deal. And I know that out-migration has come up a few times over the last few weeks even. We're not bringing people to Alaska at the same rate that they're leaving. And some of those other topics, inflation, housing, childcare, end up really affecting this. So at the same, you know, in the same way that I talked about communities or local governments keeping communities whole earlier in the presentation, it is increasingly a challenge to be able to do that and counter some of these state and system level impacts that we're seeing. PERS is one of our the state pension system is a huge driver for municipal considerations. You're familiar with the 22% cap on employer contributions into the system. The state is picking up an additional 3.1% beyond that as an additional state contribution. I mean, it's worth keeping in mind that 17% of that overall is going to the net pension liability. So the unfunded liability that's out there drags down the ability for local governments to contribute to and provide other types of benefits. So whereas you know, it might be 3% that's going to an employee for for the normal cost of a DB plan or 6 for a DC plan, it's a much larger number that actually could be available if that net pension liability didn't exist. So there's a number of areas that we're interested in having conversations about that would improve an employer experience and potentially have the impact of increasing recruitment and addressing retention challenges. Some of these are easy, and by easy I mean require less of the state budget. Some of these require more. It is in statute. I think that if an employer isn't making a payment on time or has non-payment, there's a 15% interest rate on that, and that's a rate that seems like a penalty when what we're trying to do is get them back to payment. It feels like a payday loan type situation. So I think that that's a rate that should come down. There are a number of communities where arrearages in past years are still haunting them and making it challenging for them to catch up. And that would be useful to identify and try to pay off. I don't think it's a big, I think we're talking a couple, like maybe $10 million, but that number would be something that could come from DCRA or others. The salary floor from 15 years ago is still requiring that local governments and others contribute $3 million or so beyond the employee base that they have right now, and that would be an area that would be interesting to have a look at and feel and see what an actuarial impact that might have if that were to be addressed. It seems like it's in our interest if government is downsizing or if we're talking about a footprint reduction. Having the ability to do that, to operate more efficiently, would be a good thing. And right now, local governments, the university, still being held to that 2008 salary floor. The state, and here's where it gets more expensive, the state could buy down that 22%. There's nothing that requires the 22% to be the floor of an additional state contribution, and the state could determine the rate at which or the amount that it would take to get down to 15%, free up 7% of a local government budget to offer an additional incentive program or additional benefit or to contribute differently into a deferred compensation plan for employees. So there's ways to increase benefits for employees through by working with employers. Finally, for those, especially smaller local governments who are part of PERS, they've tried to leave, they still have the net pension liability that, you know, was supposed to last till 2039, carries forward from beyond that now. Many years could last till 2099. It would be beneficial to small local governments that are struggling to be able to opt out of the program without that continuing liability. It would require the system to absorb those costs or the state to pick it up, but those would all be impactful for employers and free up funds for recruitment and retention. For education, a number of resolutions out there related to public education. We did pass just in December support for increase to the BSA, including to see it adjust better for inflation. And I think a big reason for that is that local governments are picking up the difference and having some real trade-offs between, not in all cases, in some cases local governments are picking up the difference and trade-offs then between increased funding for schools who are, have shortfalls and parks and rec or deferred maintenance or public safety. We have resolutions that reference, you know, a reevaluation of what the local contribution looks like. I think one thing to know is that the required local contribution has increased over these last almost 10 years because property valuation has increased at the same time that the state's BSA is kept steady. So local governments are picking up more of the difference between the BSA and what's now required of them. At some point, we need to address the school bond debt reimbursement program. There's currently a moratorium for that, but what we're seeing is districts that used to, or local governments that used to use the school bond debt reimbursement program, competing with rural districts and others for the grant program that has a very similar match structure, but is a very different funding mechanism. So if it's not a return to school bond debt reimbursement, then, you know, figuring out what that new program that incentivizes investments into schools and offers a state partnership, I think that would be something that we'd want to talk with the legislature about. I think the school construction and major maintenance has been a priority for years for us. For just the grant program over the last 20 years, for the $300 million in projects that are submitted each year, for the $2.6 billion that's on the six-year list identified by school districts, only 8% on average a year is funded through that grant program. Some years none, at the cost of, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of applications into the program. So we've thought about it in terms of, just as there's a BSA for instruction and operations, maybe there's a BSA or a base allocation identified for at least major maintenance. Ultimately, what we want are districts in a position not to have to decide between instruction and fixing a roof. And if we can offset some of those costs, if the state could offset some of those costs, that would be, I think, important. Finally, there is a provision in statute that there's a hold harmless provision, but after 3 years, it goes away. So if a district decreases in size and wanted to close a school, they're actually penalized for closing that school. And what we want to do, again, is give local governments options to operate more efficiently and scale up and down based on student size and not have penalties that go with that.
Mr. Andreessen, if I could pause you here for a second. So these are a lot of really great kind of meaty topics, and looking for your future slides, it's all the same. These are all really big topics. I guess my question is, as you're going on, you know, do you prioritize these, and which of these are you really focusing on kind of running to ground? Because any one of those would be a fairly major policy accomplishment if it got through. And so does your organization sort of do that, like choose one and run it through to conclusion, or is it more sort of general than that?
Sure. Thank Chair Dunbar. We do have priorities. I think the pension system fixes, to the extent, I think the resolution from this last year, to the extent that a DB plan or fix is available for the state pension system, we would want some of these to be included in that in that effort. So address employees and employers and find some good working room there. So that is one of three priorities. A second is school construction and major maintenance. So some combination of addressing these issues and is probably a second priority for us.
Thank you. Please continue. Yep.
And I will speed up, maybe. I don't know. They are meaty topics, right?
They are.
economic development, that's easy. But I will frame, I mean, I use economic development, I think, coming back to housing and childcare. For this committee, I'll note that we do have a housing task force. It's coming out with the recommendations here over the course of this week. So if that comes up in future meetings, or if there's interest by the committee, we could talk more about what we're finding and ways that local governments and the state could work together to address that. Similarly, for childcare, we might have some contributions there. And we do view those both as, I mean, bottom line, it's economic development, it's keeping communities whole. For transportation, I think the important to know, we've got a good working relationship with the Alaska DOT. And continue to work through where local governments have issues on that front. How to, you know, make sure our budget estimates are clear between the two. To the extent that it's in the state's interest to transfer ownership of state assets to a local government, to make sure that that's a negotiated process and not check the box and now you take that up. And you know, that probably goes back way both ways. How do we make sure that this is being accomplished in both our interests? I talked about municipal harbor facility matching grants. And I will commend the department for moving forward with regional transportation planning organizations, RTPOs, which may need an amendment to statute. I think that'll probably get taken up elsewhere.
Just on that briefly, is AMATS an RTPO or is that a separate kind of entity?
Right, Chair Dunbar, AMATS is an MPO, a Metropolitan Planning Organization. So we have AMATS and FAST, the Fairbanks one. MATSU will have an MPO coming up. Everybody else isn't eligible for an MPO, but the value of an MPO is that you have dedicated, you've got access to federal funding, planning dollars, and your projects get moved into the STIP by reference, I think. And so an RTPO could do that at a regional level to some extent and have some support for bringing up regional priorities into the state list.
Okay, so a follow-up to that. So when you say regional, do you mean something, you know, larger than just Anchorage? It could be the MATSU and Anchorage and maybe Kenai together. Or are you talking about, you know, there isn't an MPO and so the Western Alaska region, are they sort of bigger or smaller than I'm envisioning with something like AMATS? Yeah.
Chair Dunbar, I think multi-jurisdictional potentially, but I think it's more, it wouldn't combine MATSU and Anchorage. It would be, you know, Kenai could add one, Southeast could add one, you know, consistent with ARDER boundaries, Alaska Regional Development Organization boundaries, Northwest Arctic could have one. And there's one that was just formed for Copper River Valley, I think, is the first. Fairbanks just added one for the region beyond FAST. Bristol Bay Borough, I think, has one out. So there's some room for greater regional collaboration. It could be multi-jurisdictional, you know, multiple cities at the table as part of that, but it brings a whole new level to planning in the state.
Interesting. Thank you. Please continue.
For energy, AML continues to support investments in and through the Renewable Energy Fund and really appreciates the work of Alaska Energy Authority and moving those projects forward. I think that well-recognized value of PCE. We do have a resolution when a municipality, say, bonds for a renewable energy project that brings the price of energy in that community down below the PCE standard, there's no ability for PCE or otherwise to reimburse them for the investments that they're making. So they see the benefit of reduced costs, but the local government actually is bearing the contribution that PCE would have otherwise made.
Yeah, it's a disincentive.
Yeah.
Is there, to your knowledge, is there legislation moving on this? This seems like a reasonable bipartisan fix.
Right. Chair Dunbar, not that I know of. We passed and we talked earlier about supply chain inflation. That's come home for bulk fuel loans, which is a program administered by Division of Community Regional Affairs. So where communities before could access this revolving loan fund, which is capped at $750,000, is what they have to access. If fuel prices are 20% more than they're used to and they need $1 million, the division is actually capped doing that. So we do have a resolution supporting increasing that cap, decreasing rates, though DCRA is doing a great job of administering that program. And then finally, grid resilience is maybe a new topic, and just for your awareness, is something that Department of Energy has funding available for, you know, tribes across the state, for AEA and others, to improve local grids. So we're supporting efforts that improve local utility operations. I'm only going to touch on a few things related to fiscal. Mandatory exemptions has been a longstanding issue, I think, for AML. Statute requires that those exemptions be reimbursed. And I've got the chart on the top right, the total exemptions by community. You can see that exemption value for Anchorage, just over $40 million. But the ratio to revenue is actually just as interesting, where for Ketchikan and Kodiak, Petersburg, that exemption value relative to revenue that they have is very different. So again, every community is different and feels this differently, but it's not just the total, it's the total relative to what they might otherwise be able to collect. And that exemption, if it weren't there, it would also readjust and level the playing field for everybody who's participating in that property valuation and collection. Presumption trust is probably a new concept for everybody, but the state does have and added last year additional presumptions to its workers' compensation statute, and which I think that we've been generally supportive of presumptions that apply to employees of municipalities. Last year I think it was breast cancer added for firefighters. A presumption trust is something that in other states has been the backstop for the claims that have been made under that presumption. So if the state says this presumption we think should be automatically compensated, backing that up with a state trust would make sense. And I think there's just in the last year, I think we can point to about $1 million in claims that have been made on that presumption. So it doesn't feel like a lot, but it actually ends up impacting employers. And finally, you're familiar with community assistance, the value of which has gone down over the years, especially if you you think about it in terms of inflation proofing. The Community Assistance Fund doesn't have accrue any return on investments. It's capped at $90 million. Any return from that goes back into the general fund or however the state decides. But allowing that fund to grow while it's managed by the state wouldn't be a bad thing in my mind, and having those extra funds available to supplant the PCE waterfall, which won't be available this year, would make up some difference there. You could also use community assistance for making additional payments or funds available to communities for like non-federal match for infrastructure or otherwise. So I think most importantly it would be that community assistance is recapitalized and the full funding can go out to communities. Public health, we've been active on the states and political subdivisions discussions about opioid settlement. There is an opioid settlement tracker out there that kind of identifies how other states are approaching the settlement. It hasn't come up yet for the legislature, but I think will. And our perspective right now is really good cooperation and effort with the states that we'll want to see ways for multi-jurisdictional investments to be able to be made. To the extent that we have long-term investments out there, we want to make sure that that's possible as well as short-term, and there might be infrastructure that's needed for addressing opioid mitigation that requires more than what might be available under other models. It's been interesting to see local governments doing more and more related to public health, and that's something that I think AML right now has been encouraging. I could take the rest of my time on Title 29, but I won't. This is also a terrible slide with the background, which is really my attempt at like this hinting a larger conversation. So the screenshot behind the text is the RUBA program best practices dashboard that you probably heard about in a couple different ways. It doesn't apply to all communities, but the majority of communities. It's the state's way of gauging whether a local government or community has the financial and governance capacity to administer utilities in different ways. And if the state's going to make an investment into a community, it wants to make sure that investment, that whoever's carrying that has the capacity needed to manage it effectively. So they do that through a set of best practices scores. Huge deep dive in the future on this. But I think the important thing that I wanted to maybe note is, you know, that scorecard at the bottom right. You know, since 2015, we haven't really seen much of an improvement in best practices scores. 10 years, roughly, of 60 on average out of 100 that communities are scoring. And I just wonder if maybe there's a different approach needed to make sure that there's investment into communities' capacity to support these projects and utilities than we've been doing so far. So it's an area where AML wants to make more direct support of communities, work with the state to make sure that happens. These best practices score two, I'll note, you know, may be a factor in whether some of this infrastructure funding, $3 billion in infrastructure funding for water and sewer, is able to go out to communities with that are unserved or underserved. If you don't rank high enough, you're not eligible for potentially some of the state funding that you might otherwise be. So a huge conversation there that we do have a resolution that walks through here's improvements that that might be out there.
We were able to hear from the division director who brought up, obviously, the RUBA program. Has AML or your members been working directly with the division director on these kind of things?
Chair Dunbar, to some extent, yeah, staff at a staff level, working with them, talking through these issues, and with DEC, and it's DEC and DCRA that are the two state agencies who have a role here. There's a long, I think, negotiated discussion about how to make improvements, but the fact that things haven't changed, you know, so much in the last 10 years means, for me, that there's maybe a very different approach needed.
Any more questions?
Yeah. There's a lot of Title 29 other items that could be addressed. And so just as we're kind of going through session, if there are bills that come up relative to these, then we'll be sure to flag them in ways that you'll have better awareness of. Public safety, we talked about the role of local governments in public safety. We are partnering with the police chiefs to maybe create a policy manual for all law agencies in Alaska that could serve as a template. So I'm excited about that opportunity. We've made progress on better funding community jails, and those are jails that local governments own and operate on behalf of the state, but are picking up some portion of the costs for those. Village police officers, there's no state funding that goes to VPOs or to local law enforcement, which is different than for like a village police officer program, which is entirely state funded. Local emergency planning committees used to get grants from the state 5 or so years ago and don't anymore. And we've seen communities' ability to conduct planning efforts for local emergencies decrease in that time. So that's something that could be addressed. Finally, I know that many of our public safety officials have commented on increased needs for facilities and equipment. There's at least for the Alaska Land Mobile Radio program, the technology needed to conduct that effectively, there's maybe a $40 million price tag on software upgrades that will have to be figured out. Finally, we have a little bit more time.
About 30 minutes.
Perfect. This is, I'll go back to Title 29 at the end there. Just in terms of the work that we're doing on infrastructure development, you know, our board of directors said, once in a lifetime opportunity, your task, AML, is to make the most of this and to maximize the benefit. Coming to Alaska, and not just to Alaska local governments, but you know, we're working with school districts, with tribal governments, with nonprofits, with businesses. What's the difference that we can make to bring funding into the state? And I think we've been, you know, effective this last year. And I mentioned the AK federal funding site earlier, so you know that that's a resource. We do have an MOA with the Alaska Department of Transportation to support and be a liaison with local governments around the state. And that's been really effective and a model really for other agencies too. And I'll say, I mean, it's a different AML. These didn't exist 5 years ago for an AML and a state agency to be working this closely together. And that's the kind of partnership that, that we want to see that, that is beneficial to the state and to local governments. That partnership has resulted in the Alaska Transportation Funding Opportunity Hub, where any local partner can submit a project through an intake form. Most recently, for a state transportation funding opportunity, responses for which were $1.2 billion in local projects. For, I think, you know, not anywhere near that in terms of opportunity, but we know there's need. And AML has a role then in looking at those projects as they come in and working with local governments and others to strengthen projects so that they could be competitive at the federal level, while DOT is working on state eligible projects. So this is, you'll hear more about this, I think somewhere over in Transportation Committee, the same presentation is occurring about this. So good work that's being done with Alaska DOT. Our thinking about how to make the most of the infrastructure investment that the federal government is making available, it's centered on collaboration and making sure that our applications are competitive. And competitiveness really relies on collaboration, as we want just to raise our game overall, that we know local governments. It would be easy to think that we're competing with each other, but the competition is the rest of the nation. So if we can raise the tide for all communities, who we're competing with is other states, other, you know, 20,000 other cities around the nation, and that's our role in that. We host a weekly office hours. We send information out about new grant opportunities and webinars every, you know, twice a week. And we're directly providing technical assistance and grant writing to local governments and others. At the end of the day, we hope that that it means that those local governments have partners in place to support them, that if they're awarded grants, they can manage them effectively, can implement these projects, and that we can address Alaska's infrastructure deficit, which last year we described as about $30 billion in need. Between schools and water and wastewater, transportation, ports and harbors, and so on. Housing, I think we estimated at $5 billion itself. So we need to, this is the opportunity for addressing that infrastructure deficit. And it'll be between local and state government, I think, and tribal government to make the difference. This is done together. The AK federal funding site is done together with the Alaska Infrastructure Coordinating Committee, which this group meets every other week and reviews all the different opportunities, what everybody's doing, avoids duplication, conflict, and looks for partnership. And so this has been a really effective way to informally address infrastructure collaboration. And we're bringing opportunities then where AML and AFN are working together to get to, you know, support tribes in applications that they're eligible for, to support that AML and Denali Commission or Rasmussen Foundation working together to, you know, do digital equity or energy investments. Finally, I think where we're headed. We've made huge progress this last year, kind of year one of a five-year investment cycle out of IJA. And there's going to be a lot more work to do. The scale of not just project need, but implementation need is pretty incredible. And I don't think AML is ready yet to do all this work. I don't know that state agencies are ready yet and tribes. So this year, I would anticipate that we start turning the corner into implementation, into project management, grant management. What does shared procurement look like? How do we address workforce concerns between projects and across regions? How do we more efficiently deliver projects so that they're not isolated? How do we report on outcomes so that we can prove to the federal government that we were compliant and did all this right and are worth more and future investment? And I think, you know, important for the state is how do we ensure that all of this is sustainable, that this isn't a one-off, a project 80s you know, put a bunch of money out into communities, but there are sustainable maintenance and operations plans, asset management plans, so that 5 years from now, everybody's got the workforce to maintain, 10 years from now, maintain what's been implemented.
If I could interrupt you there for a second. Yeah. That last point I'm really concerned about, and I'd love to hear your thoughts and other folks. I've spoken with DOT about this. So for one example, DOT builds about 3% more lane miles in Anchorage every year, but they don't increase their snow removal budget or their maintenance budget, or we don't increase it. We haven't. And so we've seen what's happened is that snow removal has degraded in Anchorage for a variety of reasons, but that's one of them. There are more lane miles to maintain, and there's the same amount of money to do it. And so I'm a little concerned about we're having those infrastructure money coming into the state, but how explicit are you being in your conversations with DOT and with local communities about who is going to maintain this? How are we going to maintain this? Can we focus not on building these sort of large traditional projects, but other things that are a little bit more integrated in the community and a little bit easier to maintain, or just repair something that we know needs to be repaired? So can you talk a little bit more about that conversation? I hope that's the one you're having.
Yeah, Chair Dunbar, I think that's the conversation we've hinted at and are hope to having this year more directly. I think the way we've framed it is, one, there's not a lot of asset management capabilities in the state right now. It's not a common occurrence, so we want to do more asset management training first. We've talked more and more about inflation-proofing maintenance budgets, which are surprisingly flat when you look at kind of 3-year, 6-year planning efforts. Everybody programs $100,000 for maintenance and every year, and we know that that doesn't. We're doing less with less. That was our mantra last year. We're doing less with less, and I even for the influx of new funding, if everything else isn't keeping up with that, then we're falling. We're going to fall behind. I think the way, so the other side of that conversation is we can't have a siloed approach anymore to maintenance and operations. It has to be local state. It has to be local. It has to be local tribal in ways that you know, more effectively leverage the partnerships that are available and the funding that each has available and step back and have more intentional planning discussions. RPOs would be, or RTPOs would be huge, just for the transportation effort. But having more planning opportunities and discussions with each other is going to be really important for that. Last year, we held the two infrastructure symposiums. Everybody focused on new money. This year, infrastructure symposium needs to focus on, all right, what's next steps and how do we maintain and sustain all the work that we're doing?
Don't see any other conversation questions. I'll just note on that too. You know, it's partially our fault as political leaders. It's not as fun to do a ribbon cutting in front of a repair as opposed to new construction. But repairs is what we really need. Repairs and maintenance of a lot of our facilities.
Oh. Or build better.
That too. That too.
We could do a whole PR campaign, social media outreach around deferred maintenance.
Yes.
Raise its game in the public mind. I think with that, thank you. I mean, as you can see, AML doing a ton of work in this in ways that we haven't really before. Our ability to deliver shared services to members is going to be part of the answer to that question. But ultimately, we want to augment the capacity of local control, local decision making, and partnerships.
Thank you, Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I want to start off by saying what a great presentation. It was really informational. I've seen, AML through two EDs before you. I remember when you were hired. And not that I wasn't impressed with the prior EDs, but I'm really impressed with you. You're really engaged, and I really appreciate that. And as we know, most states have a league. And in order to be a member in National League of Cities and NACOL, you have to have a league. And one of my biggest concerns when you were first hired, I think you'll remember, was the relationship with AML and National League of Cities. And National League of Cities was really big on my agenda because I was involved with them since 1999, served on the board and a couple other committees. And I knew how important this organization is to our state as a whole. And you told me you were going to get more involved. And so my question is, what's the relationship now with NLC? And NACO's important too, but NLC is my focus. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Gray Jackson, through the chair. So National League of Cities is the national level municipal association. All of the state leagues participate in their activities and encourage cities to attend their events. And I will say one of the things that I've been most excited about with NLC is their advocacy efforts have been huge. The work that they did around ARPA, CARES Act, has meant the world, and it meant that we could bring information to our members, to local governments, to tribes that said, here's how you implement this and you be successful and comply with all the federal regulations. So they have been incredibly helpful these last few years. I have taken your words to heart, Senator Gray Jackson. I'm on the board of National League of Cities this past year. I've attended meeting conferences. It took me 4 years to get there, but have attended their conferences, just continually impressed with how skillful they are. There's work, that's led to greater cooperation between league directors in Alaska, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Montana, kind of Western Pacific Northwest states, trading information about how do we make rural communities, small communities, make a difference in NLC, what are lessons that we're learning about supporting local governments in our smaller communities. And I think that's been some real value added from that relationship.
If I can follow up.
Yes.
Chairman, I just want to say thank you. I really appreciate your involvement. And even though I'm a state legislator now, I try to stay on top of what NLC is doing and maybe once a year attend one of their conferences, because it is a very important organization. So thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. Any other questions? Yes, Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nils, thank you very much for the great presentation today. Looking forward to hearing more from you and anything that the state legislature can do in Title 29 to help out local government through statute changes, regulation changes. Certainly non-monetary issues are great. If we can streamline things at the local level, always happy to hear that. And didn't you have a speaker from the National League of Cities at the recent annual conference?
We did, Senator Bjorkman, through the chair. Thank you. And yes, we've had, they've participated in some of our childcare, early education childcare. We model, we have a Cities of Opportunity program that we've modeled off of NLC. And we have a dozen emerging municipal officials that participate in that program, which is really neat. I think we had their previous president at our annual conference. And now that we've deconflicted our conference and theirs, they can attend ours. Okay. Yep.
Good. Do you have a follow-up, Senator Bjorkman?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Senator Giesel, do you have any? Well, thank you so much for your presentation, Mr. Andreessen. And I'll just say, it's extremely broad portfolio of issues. And I'll say, I think similarly, this committee has a similarly broad portfolio, except when we're explicitly displaced by something like the Education Committee, for example. And so as these legislative issues start to move, I've expressed to the President of the Senate that I'd like to have some of them come to this committee. And so perhaps we will see you back or some of your member organizations. So thank you so much for being here today. With that, the next meeting of the Senate Community Regional Affairs Committee will be on Thursday, February 2nd, 2023 at 1:30. We will have the department overviews from both the Department of Public Safety and the Department of Corrections. The time is 2:45, and this hearing of the Senate Community Regional Affairs Committee is now adjourned.